Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, pull the press.
The Media Project offers a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the news media, with some insights into the dilemmas that often confront news leaders with some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, and I'm here with my colleagues Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. Let's see, we're going to talk about Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette. What's in your mind today?
You know, I thought I could stop talking about AI, but I just can't. A new study came out this week from the University of Maryland that said at least 9% of U.S. Articles or stories posted on U.S. websites were written at least partially by AI, and a lot of those wasn't even disclosed that they were AI. So we need to really address this.
Okay, we will get to that. That is a good, and this is a topic we're going to be talking about every week on this show from now on, I have a feeling. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, what are you thinking about?
I'd also like to talk about creator journalists. And those are people who, I used to call them independent journalists, people who are labeling themselves as journalists but are not working for mainstream media, but many of them were.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm one of those people now. I think this is a great topic. The Upstate American is a Substack publication that is, it's mailed out every week to people. And so I'm no longer affiliated with the news organization. And think about how many people are in that category. Some folks have left well-paying jobs in the news media. Some people are making a lot of money from it. I'm not among them. But, you know, in some ways, this creator economy in journalism is beginning to realize the promise of the internet that was seen at the dawn of the digital age, you know, the notion that the ease of creating content online would empower people by removing what the economists call the barriers to entry. You know, when you needed a press to report something in a newspaper, control of information resided in those who could afford a press or could afford to hire somebody who owned a press. But now anybody can be a publisher. And with platforms like Substack and Patreon and Beehive functioning as distributors, you can reach a mass audience from the comfort of your kitchen table, which gives individuals power to be journalists or influencers or commentators. But it also diminishes the credibility that used to attach by simply being somebody who could get a press at your disposal. Or does it? Does it diminish? Do you think there is still the credibility?
I think that there's more question mark about the people, about the reporting, but there are a number of people who had made a name for themselves in mainstream media and I think have earned the respect and credibility, and then you tend to turn to them. I'm a little confused in the process about if you're a creator journalist, are you really a journalist if you're a commentator? Or are you a journalist only if you're providing new information and trying to tell a story, or can you successfully weave both? When I read yours and some others, Ken Tingley's and Glenn Kessler's, there's a lot of good journalists or former professional journalists or whatever you want to call us. You can see that they are providing real information, statistics, providing attribution for where their information is coming from. So it's not just off-the-cuff commentary.
It's not just a guy next to you on the bar stool if you're actually giving people information that is verified, even if you're doing it with a twist, as I do. I give my opinions there, but it's not just ranting, I hope.
Yeah, which could be a plus.
You know, it has real challenges, though, I imagine. I mean, when there are millions of people out there writing Substack columns, how do you rise to the top? And from the other direction, what is the challenge for the reader who wants to find really cogent, interesting content? And how do you curate your feed every day so you're catching the right people? The other thing that I always maintain that everybody needs a good editor. And so when you have this kind of the rise of this kind of journalism, are the stories being vetted the way they used to in the old newsroom system? Or do I just need to throw that system away?
I think you're exactly right. Everybody needs an editor if you're going to be, especially if you're going to be reporting something that has not been previously reported. You know, we can all use an editor for copy editing. And when you find that you've got a typo or something or a word that you didn't intend to have, you just kind of, oh no, and I published it because you didn't get a second and third set of eyes. But on the other hand, for reporting, an editor is essential for that second guessing of what you're doing or pushing you, thinking of another source that you should be going to. And so if you're this creator economy is reaching journalism, I think one of the reasons why so much of it is just opinion journalism is because you don't have the confidence that you're getting it right if you're a serious journalist, if you're just operating as a solo practitioner. I think you need to have some humility as a journalist if you're reporting to know that you need somebody else there with you. So that's why I only do secondary reporting. That is, I'm not actually going out and getting stories.
Right, but you're attributing to reliable sources.
Yes, yes.
So that's important. And you can afford to do this for the pleasure of doing it. And
yeah, it amounts to the number of subscribers. I makes about 15% of my income. So it's not like I'm trying to get a lot of money from my Substack column. But it's nice when folks pay.
Are those that are really doing journalism, are they getting press passes to attend press conferences? Do they have libel insurance? Who do you sue if you're unhappy with what they've done? Do they have, you know, deep enough pockets to even bother suing? There are all sorts of industry questions that arise, especially if you're doing hard news reporting. Do you get a seat at the White House briefing room? Apparently you can.
It depends on what you're writing, yeah. If you're writing something that is sufficiently supplicative to the president, I suppose you can get in, you know? But it also raises the question about the trust in information from news organizations. It puts this creator economy puts the burden on consumers to determine what is and is not real. And in that, we're not very good at it, we news consumers, it seems to me. Because a lot of stuff that is out there is simply not true. And we can go in a couple of different directions here. I mean, part of the problem is that you have a White House itself that is posting fictionalized stuff, material that is, well, Judy, you were interested in AI generation. I mean, the White House is using AI to generate memes and videos that are fraudulent.
You know, if you've listened to me in the past, one of the things I like to do, well, I don't like to do it, but I do it on social media. If someone writes something that's or reposts something that's incorrect or wrong, I will tell them that it's wrong and link them to correct information. I've seen in the last maybe couple of months, AI-generated videos, these Soros videos especially, people doing things that aren't real, and I will point that out, and the response I get from average Americans is, oh, yeah, I know it's not true, but it's still funny. It's still something I want to watch. And I think we're going down that horrible rabbit hole where things are not, the truth is not important. We're, everything's a movie. Everything is not real. Everything's a comic book.
It's terrible. And there's a question of how much should the mainstream media be reporting to try to debunk those kind of things, because you're giving it more credibility. You're spreading the word about these the false videos and narratives.
That is a hard decision. And you know, as editors, we face those kinds of decisions anyway. Are we going to report about this if we know something is not true? That video of President Trump in a jet fighter dropping presumably a load of feces on the demonstrators on No King's Day was pretty outrageous. And it was on the official White House media site. It was generated by taxpayer dollars.
I know this is a little off topic, but sometimes the media, when this initially popped up, they were like trying really hard to identify this as brown liquid or looks like mud.
Because you can't say the word. Yeah.
And it was just an interesting approach to it as it initially aired. And when I first saw this, I go, there's no way the president of the United States posted this.
Oh, why would you even have a doubt for a second?
I am so naive. I still, you know, he still continues to shock me.
Wow. I was just so disgusted when I saw the loss of civility from the top down is not new anymore. And to have done that, to say, if you disagree with me, ha ha, I'm going to poop all over you. And that's what all of his supporters should do. Or if you're protesting policy or him, whatever, that it means that you must hate America. And so that feeding that, the hatred and divisiveness out of the White House, I don't think we should pull any punches in reporting that.
So PolitiFact did an analysis and found out that Trump's Truth Social account, that's his own personal, you know, social media platform, has used AI in 36 posts since he was inaugurated. Of those, 21 promoted or sensationalized his image, and 12 of them degraded his opponents. For example, when he was criticized for accepting a luxury jet from Gutter, his account shared an AI image of the Statue of Liberty with a sign around its neck that said, "Gift from a foreign nation."
That's so much the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so when we look at what we're doing as journalists and what kind of stories, it seems like we're making a mountain out of a molehill when we look at 9% of articles published by U.S. newspaper brands were at least partially written by AI. Well, I'm still concerned about that because that remains a problem that undercuts our credibility. And I think we need to hold the line in some respects. This is research from the University of Maryland. They used an AI detector program. And they found this at least partially generated by AI. They found AI use was much higher in smaller local outlets compared to larger national newspapers. And they found they, as expected, a lot of these stories were sports stories or weather stories. But the other point that they made was that these references or these uses of AI were not always disclosed. And that's one of my causes that I like to champion is if you're going to use it, at least tell the people what you're doing.
Do you think you might be holding your finger in the dike there? I mean, it just seems to me like this is just going to get more and more, and that it's going to become sort of par for the course that certain use of AI in newspaper stories is going to happen.
But you can't just shrug off the problems that brings and the challenges with the reliability of the information. I was reading through assignments for my students who had to decide what they're going to be writing about for their next story topic that go to the class and maybe go to the student newspaper.
Students at the University of Albany. We didn't mention that teaching there.
You.
Yeah, good.
Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Yep.
And so one student wrote how they're going to write about how AI has come such a long way and it's streamlining reporters' work and helping with the accuracy in their output. Hmm. And I just wrote back, "We need to talk tomorrow."
Yeah.
So we'll... I have a class right after this taping.
A great learning experience.
So yeah, yes, there are pluses, but oh boy, are there challenges with what to believe and where to get your information. And
well, in light of what you were saying earlier about not having editors on a lot of content, especially if you're using AI, that needs to be very carefully vetted and edited, right? And there just aren't that many editors on even most legacy news sites these days. So that's a very difficult thing.
Yeah, I sent you all a correction that I came across earlier this week where the last name Holland had been changed to Netherlands. Now, that could have been...
In the Wall Street Journal. In the print version of the Wall Street Journal, Cindy Holland's name was Cindy the Netherlands.
Now, it might have been AI. It may have been autocorrect, which is kind of like AI, but it's not as sophisticated. But it's the danger of not having someone human being the last set of eyes on anything before you put it out there for the public.
Right, because even if you didn't know what that person's last name is, seeing the Netherlands should have rang a bell.
You would think that that would jump at somebody if there is an editor.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as a news organization as large as, was it Wall Street Journal that mm-hmm. had that? That you would think that another pair of eyes would have caught that.
You would think. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. That was Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick is here. I'm Rex Smith. And we would welcome your thoughts. media@wamc.org is how you share your thoughts with us, because we do have a couple of pieces of mail from listeners.
We get mail?
Hey, we get mail. How about that? Here we go. Will from Troy writes to say, "Have any of the newspapers made trying to obtain information the story itself? Pick a topic, apply for the information, and then write regular articles about the obfuscation and the delay. Keep it in front of the public. Keep pressure on state legislators and the governor." This arising, I guess, from our conversation last week about New York Focus, this fine investigative nonprofit newsroom, and how many of their stories have been stymied by delays under freedom of information law.
You know, we used to do this quite a bit when the freedom of information law first came around in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, we would put it across the front page, banner headline that they were withholding the content that we were trying to get. Then at some point, we came to the conclusion that we shouldn't be writing about ourselves as much. And so we didn't do that as much as perhaps we should have. It's a good idea to bring this back up because I do think that people will care.
Maybe in legacy publications where it might be an interesting column to have as an ongoing column, public information watch, and every day spotlight a different story that you're trying to pursue that you're being stonewalled on by public officials.
Even the column that talked about what you got rejected on. I asked for the copy of the annual budget, I got rejected. Or I asked for this testimony, and look, it's all blacked out. It's all redacted. It can be fun. A good reporter could make it fun. Maybe AI could do it, make it fun too.
Yeah, and I think there's opportunities with websites to have a drop down on, you know, news we're trying to get for you, or we got, you know, bashed down again, or something where those stories have more than a one-day shelf life, because you're going to miss stories like that. But they should have a lasting value.
I'm going to kind of name drop here. I was talking last week with Dean Baquet, the former executive editor of the New York Times.
No, he is name dropping.
It was about what the Times is doing in that regard. You know, he created this feature now, and the print edition of the Sunday paper, pages 2 and 3, are filled with kind of a look at the news that they're presenting to you, including background on how they got the story. And he was saying that they learned, somewhat to his surprise, that people are really interested in how you go about getting the story. So they present one of those every week, at least, a little bit of a look into how the story was made. So that's kind of good. We used to say about legislation, you know, if you like sausage,
you don't want to see how the sausage is made.
If you like sausage or democracy, you don't want to look at how it's made.
Oh, good one.
I do think that anytime I've ever been out in public talking about journalism, you do get a good crowd. I think people remain fascinated by it. I mean, journalism movies do well. There's something about what we do that we find exciting, but the public finds fascinating.
Do you think that it would make a difference in credibility of news organizations if we shared more of the sausage making, or would it be problematic? I ask this because I'm looking at the latest poll from Pew Research Center about trust in information. And the percentage of adults who say they have a lot or some trust in the information they get from national and local news organizations or social media, it's not good. 56% of adults say they have a lot or some trust the information they get from national, down 11 points. And now those who have at least some trust the information from their local news organizations remains higher at 70%, but that's still dropped from 80% in March, 82% in 2016. So trust in the news sources is declining. Would increased transparency help?
Couldn't hurt.
You know, did you ever consider live streaming your daily news meeting, for example?
Oh, well, I worried that you would monitor it.
Exactly. And I wouldn't have David Gastina to clean me up.
Yeah, we actually tried at one point doing a little live feed right after our news meeting, where I would do a little 5-minute, hey, here's what's going to be on the front page of the Times Union tomorrow. And realize, you know, this is not a good idea. Sorry. If you're just joining us, that's Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and The Record, and I'm Rex Smith, alumnus of the Times Union, etc. Another piece of mail that came from one of our listeners, location of Micah not being presented. What stunned me when I heard about the destruction of the White House East Wing, Micah writes, was that the news media apparently missed the story until the wing was being torn down. How did the media miss this? Further, when I searched to see images and diagrams and how it would appear in relation to the rest of the White House, I couldn't find these until days later. How could this be? The second part I can answer. There were no diagrams presented because the White House clearly sat on it so that there would be no opposition. But, you know, we knew this was coming. He said, right? Trump said he's going to do a renovation, but we didn't know he was going to tear down the whole East Wing.
Well, I happened to be in France at the time, visiting Versailles, not realizing that that was happening on that day. I knew he had plans to build a ballroom. So I felt like I had the inside scoop on what it was going to look like.
But, I mean, I thought the letter raised an interesting point, because I, too, was concerned about why did no one notice that the East Wing was being vacated of furniture, or people were being moved. No one within that whole wing was tipping anybody off. And then they moved heavy equipment over there. Was no one, I guess they understood that there was going to be some construction, But when they pulled up the big dump trucks where they were going to dump all that demolition debris, why didn't anybody know that? Was there no effort made to save any of the historic trim or anything else that might have been historic on the building? It just seems that there must have been some buildup that totally was missed by the White House press corps, or maybe they aren't allowed in the East Wing.
Well, that is true. You're not allowed in the East Wing, and so the press corps was kept out of there. But it does raise a question, just to show you how different things are. When the west front of the Capitol was renovated 30 years ago, those columns were taken down and moved out to what has become the National Botanical Garden. And it's an amazing scene, all these columns rising up out of the earth on the northeast side of Washington. There's this fabulous array of columns that were actually rescued from the U.S. Capitol when it was rebuilt. That kind of thing is the way that this is typical of how historical structures are retained. The answer, by the way, to Michael's question about weren't basic permits required when the contractors themselves have obtained some documentation just to protect themselves, the answer to that is no. The White House is exempt, and this has been reported, from the kind of review. The White House, the Supreme Court, and I guess the Capitol are exempt from the requirement for regulatory review. But usually in all previous renovations, it has gone through historical review anyway.
But Judy is correct in saying, well, where the heck is the News Corps?
Yeah.
That people couldn't get wind from a great number of people who must have known this was about to happen and didn't get wind of it to report it. That's kind of troubling.
Yeah, they were too focused on something else, or they weren't paying attention, or it wasn't any of their business, or obviously their editors have to be asking them some questions.
Well, or maybe they're covering the government shutdown, or maybe they're covering the downing of alleged drug cartel boats. And
I think that does go to a question we were talking about last week, that there are so many stories that we need to be covering, that stuff that used to be days running front page stories now get relegated after day one to inside pages if you're in print, or they get dropped off altogether from a five-minute newscast. So how do you keep on top of stories when there's so many?
And the few stories that I did read about the teardown did seem to mention they don't need permission, they don't require any kind of input from anybody, you know, they were allowed to just tear it down.
Now, don't do this, by the way. If you're, you know, Micah writes, aside from the above, if the administration can do this with no procedure, no warning, and by one person's whim, does this mean that that person can paint the Liberty Bell red or chisel away at the Statue of Liberty's gown so that instead she's wearing a bikini? Can he take Lincoln out of his chair and put him in it instead? What Donald Trump can get away with.
Don't give him ideas, man.
Well, you know, he does want to put up
Mount Rushmore.
An arc. Well, he wants to put up an arc like the Arc de Triomphe. And so I think we should bear in mind this is probably coming our way sometime in the next 3 years.
That's a great use of our taxpayer money and time. And actually, in some of the stuff that's being funded, this is another good example of good reporting, that some of these, say the East Wing renovation, things are being funded by organizations and individuals who are currying favor from the president, and that the public needs to know who are these supporters. What are they going to get for their money?
Worth making note of, absolutely. So media at WAMC.org is how you interact with us. Okay, a couple of quick points here, folks, if you want to offer some thoughts. Barbara and Judy, any thoughts about the CBS changes? John Dickerson, anchor of the CBS Evening News, is leaving. This is a number of layoffs, four correspondents and whole units being shut down.
One more nail in the coffin of CBS, I'm afraid.
You know, I love John Dickerson. I'm really sorry to see him go. One of the things that got leaked out of a CBS news meeting, and we talk about news media early, was that Barry Weiss was suggesting a follow-up to the Louvre heist would be a good interview would be with Dan Brown, who wrote the book, which is a fine enough sidebar. But the fine folks at CBS who really look at things more seriously thought, what expertise does this guy have, and what could he add to our hard news coverage of this dramatic heist? And so that largely got poo-pooed on social media as an example of the fact that she doesn't know what she's doing.
She's never been a news reporter. She is an opinion journalist now running one of the major news organizations of the country.
But she has a sense for what people will turn to and click on.
Maybe.
You know, the Dan Brown was touring, and I saw Dan Brown books all over the place when I was in France.
Hmm. Interesting.
Last week during the heist.
Okay.
I'm innocent.
Opinion about this. Radio Free Asia will halt news operations. We've already lost Radio Free Europe. We've lost Radio Liberty. So what are we to think? Are we we are now basically giving up the effort to present American-style journalism to the rest of the world?
This is really distressing. And the only thing I can think of at this point is, are we going to be able to bring it back once the administration changes? I don't think you're going to do anything to stop what the Trump administration is doing to this segment of what we do to promote democracy, but what's going to come afterwards? Can we rebuild the East Wing?
So finally, folks, we have to take note. We have just passed the time, the anniversary of the War of the Worlds, when the death ray supposedly destroyed metropolitan New York. Monday, October 31st, 1938, Halloween, when the Orson Welles drama supposedly terrorized a lot of Americans.
Unless you were really listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah.
How do you have a ventriloquist on the radio?
Good question. I don't get that. You know, I guess those are the golden age.
But see, there was, even before AI, there were things that sort of confused people, but didn't confuse as many people as we might have thought.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That's the Media Project for this week. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, David Gustina, for putting up with all this, and for you folks for joining us. Thanks. Come back again next week for another edition of The Media Project.
Interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspaper men are such a...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.